When I was a young boy, I don't remember who gave it to me, but I received a gift of a boomerang. And I don't know how many hours I spent with it, but to me it was just a fascinating thing. I think I spent more time jumping the neighbor's fence to retrieve it than I actually got it back in my hands. But I was fascinated by this thing because, of course, it's a curved piece of wood, and if thrown properly, it tends to come back to you. And it may look very simple in its design, but the whole concept of a boomerang actually uses a lot of complex laws of physics to operate as it does. In simple terms, a boomerang is simply two wings joined at a slight angle. So if you ever look at it, they're opposite directions. And so with it being essentially two wings, they function much like an airplane wing functions in terms of physics. And what that's called is Bernoulli's principle that creates the lift that allows a plane to fly the way it does. So the trailing edge, if you will, of the boomerang always flies into the wind as it rotates, and so this design, as I mentioned, provides the lift as an airplane wing does. But in order to return to the sender, then you have additional, essentially what they call propeller motion, that as it rotates, it creates this centrifugal force that tends to bring it back from where it started. And this has to do with the uneven speed of the wings. It can be the interaction with the wind can change all of these things, many other factors. But if it's thrown at the proper angle and with enough force and the conditions are right, the boomerang will make a gentle arc as it goes out, and it will come back again to the thrower. And while it may be easy to look, it may seem easy as you look at it to throw a boomerang, it's oftentimes not. And there's a simple joke that underscores this principle. What do you call a boomerang that doesn't come back? A stick. But in considering this, I think there's some great spiritual principles that tie in with this aspect of what you put out and what you bring back. In biblical terms, this is called sowing and reaping. And that's what I'd like to cover today. Let's begin our thoughts then in reading from Scripture in Galatians 6. Mr. Warner Schmidt, can I adjust this mic? It's going to probably make some noise. Is that okay? All right. It was just kind of right in the middle of my line of sight for reading. So Ephesians 6 and in verse 7, the Apostle Paul writes here, he says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap." The effort, the actions of what you put out is what tends to come back. Now, the world talks about this in terms of karma, but it's not karma because it's based on godly principles and spiritual laws. So to continue here, he says in verse 8, "For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." And so we see this cause and effect principle here, if you will, both on a physical level and a spiritual level. We can look at something like the food laws, and we can primarily see the physical aspects of it. I mean, there are reasons why God does not have us eat pig. You can never cook it enough to get all the parasites out. It's just problematic. They're not designed to be eaten. And so there are physical laws that even show if you have proper diet, if you stay away from things like that, that typically you're going to have better health. That's reaping also what you sow. But even spiritually, there are applications with even in that food law, but many other things. But then we see in these things also God's desire, if you will, for us to have the right benefit of what we're doing. Our spiritual lives depend on how successful we throw, if you will, that spiritual boomerang of sowing and reaping. And it may take skill like it does physically. You know, we learn over time. I'm always grateful for God's mercy and patience with us as we learn these things, because it can take a certain amount of spiritual skill to be learned and developed over years to do things the way God would truly have us do it. How many of you have seen or are familiar with a movie called Secondhand Lions? It's a great movie. I would recommend it. There's not a lot of movies I would necessarily recommend, But this one is a great story. I won't go into the whole premise of the story, but there's one scene that I just always get a kick at. There was two brothers and the nephew that lived with them. And the two brothers were just these kind of crotchety set in their ways, but they were very talented in different respects. But they had come into money, and they were known in the area to, you know, the rumors grew about how much money they had. And so every traveling salesman would try to hit them up for something. And they would usually try to scare them away with a shotgun or these various things. But one guy showed up one time with seeds. So he opens up his trunk, back of his car, all these seeds. He's trying to sell them all these seeds. And they had decided they needed to do something with their land, and they were going to be gentleman farmers, and so they made this huge garden plot with all these seeds, and they just had the seed packets. I don't know if you've ever done this. You take the seed packet, put it on a stick at the end of the row so you know what you planted, and you're hoeing and you're watering and you're waiting for these things to grow and be able to harvest. And so they had rows after rows and rows of these things, and one day they're out there weeding, and the nephew says to the uncles, "I thought we planted whatever in this row." And they said, "We did." And he said, "I thought we planted this in this row." And they said, "We did. And we planted corn over here." And he said, "Yes, we did." And he said, "So why does it all look like corn?" So the salesman had swindled them with just cheap corn. They didn't know any differently. And they planted all this stuff expecting all of these different vegetables to grow. The point being, it doesn't matter what you think you're putting out there. What you actually put out is what you get back. Right? This is the spiritual principle. Let's look at Isaiah 55. Because even God desires for a return, if you will, on what he is doing with all of us. He has created the universe. He's created this world. It's a truly amazing. He has given us life, and all of it is for the potential of being in his family. And in order to do that, he has to provide to us initially a measure of his spirit, an earnest down payment, if you will. And then as we work with God and as that spirit grows, we grow spiritually, become more like him. And so God is looking for a return. He's looking for engagement. In Isaiah 55 and verse 11, we read this. It says, "So shall my word be to me that goes forth." He's talking about the things that happen in the world in the previous verse. You know, when the rain comes, the plants thrive. The water goes into the streams and the creeks and the rivers, and the fish are benefited. It goes into the oceans, and we have this whole cycle that returns. And so then he says in verse 11, "This is what I want my word to be like." He says, "When it goes forth from my mouth, it shall not return to me void." It shall not return to me without having accomplished something. "But it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I send it." So the Bible in basic English. I don't oftentimes read other translations, but I thought this one was really good. Same verse, Isaiah 55:11 in the Bible in basic English says, "So will my word be which goes out of my mouth. It will not come back to me with nothing done, but it will give effect to my purpose and do that for which I have sent it." So again, God is not just putting corn out there saying it's going to be something else, right? He's giving us opportunity to do all these different things, but he's expecting these things to return, to grow, to benefit, even outside of us. And in this way, God is the ultimate purveyor of this boomerang principle that I'm talking about here today, that he expects to reap what he has sown. We even have parables from Jesus Christ to this effect. The parable of the talents is one, for instance. The parable of the sower is another one, that God expects something to be returned. We even see this going back to Genesis 12, and when God interacted with Abraham and made the covenant with him and ultimately promised a blessing through Abraham that would bless the whole world, we know that was the Messiah to come. But to even consider that he was not just giving Abraham blessings. God is a God that would do that, but it wasn't just that. That because of Abraham and because Abraham responded to what God wanted him to do and be, he could use this to even bless more people. So let's go to Matthew 10 next. One of the principles that can be lost when we only look at ourselves selfishly. I'll use an expression. I don't know if it's just mine, but it's one that I think of every so often. That some of the cheapest people I've known are the people that are the most wealthy I've ever met. Because it can be easy that you get to a certain point and you can have money. You can be comfortable. All your needs are met and you have money to spend. But you can get selfish. You can begin to worry that you're going to lose all this and you'll have nothing. And that's easily done with human nature. But Christ is reminding us here, Matthew 10 and in verse 8. He says here, in speaking to the 12 as he was going to send them out, these various things they should do, to heal the sick, to cleanse the lepers, to raise the dead, to cast out demons. And this is why, the end of verse 8, freely you have received, freely give. None of us, by anything that we said or did, obligate God to do anything for us. It is out of his mercy, if you will, that he says, because you respond to me, I will bless you. Now, he still blesses mankind, doesn't he? He still has the rain that comes and the plants that grow and all that we have, the air to breathe and such that's in the world. But that's because God is still working out his plan of salvation. There still is going to be a time of accounting, isn't there? So in considering this boomerang principle, if you will, it's not only just good things. It can be wrong things, which is the caution we have in our calling. You know, the problem with sin is if we repeat it often enough, it becomes a habit, right? That's the spiritual principle used in the wrong way. It comes back to us still, but it comes back with bad things. You know, people that smoke their whole life. Sometimes just people that live in a house where people smoke their whole life. You know, you can have health problems. That comes back. You live a good life. You eat properly. You eat better than, you know, a lot of people may, you're going to have benefits out of that as well. But let's consider something. I won't go back and read it. I'll just recount it. But in Judges chapter 1, around verses 5 through 7 or so, the tribe of Judah fought with a king named Adoni-Bezek, and they had captured him. This king had a terrible reputation in the area, very violent, because whenever he would capture an area, a people, he would take the leadership especially, and he would cut off their thumbs and toes. This is a way basically to hobble them and humiliate them. And so he was captured by the tribe of Judah, and they cut off his thumbs and toes. Sort of this retribution, if you will. And the king understood what had been done. He said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to gather scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. The difficulty we can have spiritually is that it's not always immediate, is it? We can see people behave improperly. We can see them engage in wrong behavior. And they can seemingly be blessed. But that's the short-term view. What is the long-term view? And so even Adoni-Bezek here showed cruelty, and he understood that he got that back. Along that line, let's look at Job chapter 4. The question is, what do we want to eventually reap? If we're throwing out a spiritual boomerang, are we throwing out the right things to receive the right things back? So Job 4 in verse 8, Eliphaz says this. He says, even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity sow trouble and reap the same. So that's the negative side, isn't it? I read an interesting snippet, if you will, in an article this past week, and it stands to reason. I guess it caught my eye because I just thought that it should be obvious. But they were talking about if you're constantly sad or angry or some of these negative emotions, if you're constantly validating that by continuing that, So you're angry, and everything you see continues to make you angry. That's a habit, right? You're reaping this. So don't be surprised if you get this back. And they say the counter to that is to teach yourself not to be angry all the time. I mean, it just seems like a simple principle, right? But yet how hard it is for some people, because oftentimes I've even heard people say this, well, I'm just pretending. That's not wrong. If you're pretending to be good, eventually you will be good, right? Because what you do, you eventually become. And this is what Eliphaz is even saying here. If we plow iniquity, if we constantly are finding ourselves in sin situations, if you will, then we shouldn't be surprised if we have these negative results. The opposite is true as well. But let's go next to Luke chapter 6. And I want to spend a little time here as we kind of dissect this section a little bit in terms of what we're covering here today. Luke chapter 6, and we're going to go through verses 37 and 38. Christ here speaking, and this is the counterpart to Matthew 7, where he's talking about not judging. And there are so many people, especially even Christians, that don't understand the principle of what he's talking about here. It is not a matter of looking at God's law and saying something is right or wrong. That's not judging. What Christ is talking about here is judging in terms of salvation, right? You're condemning people. You're saying they're not good enough, these sort of things. And so then in Luke 6 and verse 37, he says here, judge not, and you shall not be judged. What he means is, if we don't judge someone to condemn them, we are not going to be judged to condemnation. Right? Christ is looking at what is our perspective. Are we looking for a reason to marginalize someone? If we are, then he's going to scrutinize us even more. To continue the thought, then, he says, condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. That's a huge thing in the world around us. I mean, I'm not looking for a show of hands, but anyone not treated poorly this past week? Somebody said something, somebody did something, somebody on the road's being stupid, your boss saying something, doing something. And this is common, isn't it? So the choice is, what do we want back to know what we need to put out? To forgive somebody, oftentimes, is more important for us than it is for them, because it sets the pattern that Jesus is talking about here. So verse 38, he says, give, and it shall be given to you. Right? This is a principle that the extremely wealthy don't get, that as you give things, more comes back. It's not a zero-sum game with God, because he has it all, right? So as he sees our desire to do what he does, because what has he withheld from us? He's not withheld anything that's good. So he sees this reflection of him when we do these things. So he says, give and it will be given to you. He says, a good measure pressed down. Now, if you've ever bought anything by volume, you can do it a couple of different ways, can't you? You can just pour it in, and that's what you get. Or somebody can pour it in, and they can take a spoon or a ladle or something with a flat edge, and they can just kind of pack it down a little bit, and then they pour a little more in, they pack it down a little bit, they pour it in. That's full, isn't it? There's no air. There's no loss of volume there, because they're really pressing it down. Shaken together. Maybe you've done that at times. You're trying to fill something, and you take it, and you kind of shake it. Everything kind of settles down a little bit. You can pour a little more in. So he says, and running over. This is the way God views these things. He says, will be put into your bosom, will be given back to you. For with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Which, again, comes back to, what are we putting out? What are we throwing in that boomerang? What are we expecting back? So we find here in verse 37 that, first of all, we're not to judge others. And a big part of that component is because we don't know the whole story, do we? We may only see a tip of what's going on. We also see in verse 37 here that we're not to condemn, or it will come back to us. I don't want condemnation. I want mercy. I want patience. So to look at the good examples of this, when have you seen this in your life? Have you done this, that you have seen what we're talking about here today? What comes back? The unexpected blessings. The times that you do something and you're not even really sure if it's the right thing to do. You know it's the right thing to do, but in that moment, was it the right thing to do? And then something comes back. In some way, God blesses that. To continue then, in verse 37, we're told to forgive others so that we can be forgiven. Christ even said this in the model prayer, didn't he? Because as, again, we forgive others, God sees him in us when we do that. Because he is quick to forgive, we're told. And he doesn't harbor a grudge, which is a truly amazing thing to consider. Verse 38, then we're told to give so that our gift returns to us. It may not be in the same form, but in most cases, it will be more than we've given. In verse 38, then we're also told the amount we give will determine what we get back. Because we can give grudgingly, can't we? You know, mister, do you have some money to spare? Yeah, I've got 20, I've got a quarter in my pocket. You can have that. Or do we say, well, wait a minute, I've got some money in my car, and we give them a $10 bill instead, or whatever it is, you know, to go above and beyond in this way. Let's read in Acts 20 something Christ said that's not recorded in the gospel accounts, which just kind of confirms what John said at the end of his gospel account, right? We don't have enough time or paper to put everything in print that Christ said and did. So we have here in Acts 20 and verse 35, Paul stating something that Christ said to him. He says, Paul speaking, I have shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must support the weak. And remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. That's an interesting thing to consider. Again, so we're talking about what we throw out and what we get back. Does it mean then that we are all to be givers? It's more blessed to give, right? Well, then how can you have all givers if there's no receivers, right? But think this through. You can be a receiver and a giver at the same time, can't you? You can give someone or allow someone the opportunity to give, in which case then you receive, they receive the blessing. The way God does these things is no one loses. Because in that respect, then we all receive, don't we? From God's perspective of a blessing and giving, then we can give someone the blessing of our receiving, as I said, and then we can all also become givers. It's just, in that respect, the lines blur, don't they? But the principle is there across the board. It is more blessed to give than to receive, which then also goes back to we reap what we sow. A giving person will receive so much more back because people will want to do things, won't they, for someone like that. Let's look at 1 Peter 3 as a caution as well. First Peter 3 and verse 9, Peter here says, do not return evil for evil or reviling for reviling, which goes again counter to human nature. I suspect all of us are familiar with the saying, if you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you back twice as hard. Right? That's the carnal way of doing things. Peter here says the opposite. Do not do that. Don't return evil for evil or reviling for reviling. So Jesus Christ was hanging on the cross on that day of Pentecost, 31 AD, and people were saying all kinds of awful things, weren't they? They personally, but also maligning him as a potential Messiah they didn't believe. You know, all these things. What did he do? He didn't revile back. It says that he did not revile back. But on the contrary, instead of returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, on the contrary, a blessing. So Peter here has moved from preaching to meddling, hasn't he? Because this is the harder thing to do. Someone does me wrong, you have to think long and hard about trying to give them a blessing. But that's exactly what God expects of us. Because he says here, knowing that you are called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. So even if we don't get back from that person what we think or hope that we would get back, God is going to bring it back as well. Another caution along this line, Hosea chapter 8. When the English translators first translated the Greek and Hebrew manuscripts into English, some of the early translations sort of set the tone for a lot of the translations that followed. And there were what we call turns of phrases that were just truly spot on. And this is one of them. It remains in our jargon, if you will, in the English language. So in Hosea 8 and verse 7 here, it says, "They sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. The stalk has no bud, and it shall never produce a meal if it should produce." The sow the wind and reap the whirlwind, which is the negative version of what we've been talking about. That's the caution, isn't it? Because what we're sowing, if we're sowing the wind, a whirlwind is not a wind, is it? It's more speed, it's more volume, there's more power. And so we have to be careful what we put out there, because a bad, if you will, spiritual boomerang will be magnified just as much as a good one will. And that's the caution. So let me just go through a few verses here, if you'll indulge me. We'll be turning a little bit here. In Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13 and verse 15. These are some of these boomerang principles to keep in mind. Hebrews 13, verse 15, we'll begin. It says, "Therefore, by him," speaking of Christ, "let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." This giving out of praise, because it makes us reflect on the positive aspects of God. "Do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased." Because even if it's not malicious, we can just forget. We're so wrapped up in our own lives, our own worlds, our own whatever, and we can forget to do good. I mean, what does it take? I have to remind myself of this on a regular basis. What does it take to pull out a card and simply says, "Been thinking of you, hope you have a good week"? I can guarantee you, anybody that receives that card, you're going to have a little bit of a smile, because they know someone cares and someone spent the time to just write that, put a stamp on it, put it in the mail. Things of this nature. Verse 17, "Obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls." They should, ideally, but if they don't, they're accountable. "As those who must give account, let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. Pray for us," what we put out. You know, of recent, we've had a couple of prayer requests. I kind of chuckle because I've said to Roxanne, we have such first world problems here, right? We're inconvenienced. We have to drive too far for church. Our chairs aren't exactly as comfortable as we want them. You know, the air conditioner's not running as cool, or it's running too cool, or, you know, all these kind of things. My brother, being in Zambia now as a senior pastor, he relayed after his last trip a couple of people that truly humbled him, because they're pretty tight on resources over there. And there are members that will walk 4 hours to church. Walk 4 hours to church. Because they have no other option. But they're going to be at church. Anybody here want to walk 4 hours to church? Don't raise your hand. You know, and then we had the prayer request from the members that were in Bangladesh. Okay? Be driven out of your home, to be beaten, to have your businesses boycotted, destruction of your property. And then the most recent one, that the potential members in Pakistan. Okay, we have a very comfortable look here. We have a very comfortable life in a lot of ways. And to remember this, I'm highlighting it not to berate anybody, but just as a reminder of what Paul says in verse 18. Pray for us. He's not just speaking about him, whoever traveled with him. I want to expand this out to all of us. Whoever's not you, pray for us. For we are confident that we have a good conscience in all things, desiring to live honorably. I mean, how do you live a Christian life in a Muslim country? You have no rights unless they decide to give them to you. And so God's mercy has been there, but still, we're not too far from this, but let's go to 2 John. 2 John 8, it's only one chapter. 2 John verse 8, John says, "Look to yourselves, that we do not lose those things which we worked for, but that we may receive a full reward. Look to yourselves. Look at what you're putting out. Look at what you're investing in." You know, it has been said that when people see someone achieve success, I mean, pick that person, somebody in sports, somebody in business, somebody in politics, or whatever it happens to be, somebody at your college, when you see the success, most people don't see all the work, probably years before that, that went into being that success. You know, to date myself a little bit, Michael Phelps didn't show up at the Olympics and win 7 gold medals because he started swimming the week before. Right? He had done this for years. His diet was meticulous. His sleep schedule was meticulous. You know, he didn't distract himself with anything else except swimming to achieve that. And then look at the reward he gets after the fact. The same thing here. Look at what God has given us. And make sure that we don't forget, so we stop putting that out to get it back. Luke chapter 6. Luke 6 and in verse 27. Christ here says, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those that hate you." And then again, that's challenging, isn't it? We don't want to love those that hurt us. It doesn't mean we have to be a doormat for them. But our attitude towards them, going back to what we read in Luke about judging, how do we love them? Oftentimes I will say to individuals who have come to me with a problem, and they're really kind of, I don't know what word to use there, the one that probably catches people the most is if I'm counseling people that are struggling within a marriage, and I ask them, "Are you praying for your spouse? Because right now you see them as an enemy. Are you living up to this? Do you pray for them?" Because it changes our perspective, doesn't it? How do they remain an enemy if we're truly praying for them? Because we want them to succeed. We won't see them as an enemy, and this is part of the principle that Christ is talking about here. So then verse 28, "Bless those who curse you and pray for those who spitefully use you." You know, the old Irish proverb is that God would turn their ankle so that we could see them coming. That's not what he's talking about here. We want them to have the right frame of mind, right? We pray for them that they would have the right frame of mind. And we also pray for them so that we don't take on those negative attributes. Verse 29, "To him who strikes you on one cheek, offer to him the other. And from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic. Give to everyone who asks of you. And from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back." God does not want us to be fixed on things rather than people. And again, in our culture, this country, the Western nations, it is very easy to get fixed on things. That's kind of how we define ourselves, and we look at ourselves whether we're doing well or not. But Christ continues in this whole section to talk about loving your enemies, that we're not just supposed to love those who love us, to go outside of that. What we're putting out again, even to the point of who we lend. You know, I learned a good piece of advice years ago. I never lend money to people. I give it to them. If I get it back, great. If they have the means to repay it back at some point. But if I never get it back, what was more important? So then verse 36, he concludes this section by saying, "Therefore, be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful," to reflect him in these things. Let's look at Ecclesiastes 11. This is another one of those great turn of phrases God inspired, and in my estimation was translated really well in terms of the language. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 1, Solomon writes here, he says, cast your bread upon the waters. I mean, at first read, that just sounds completely silly, doesn't it? What happens when you cast bread on waters? It gets all soggy and it sinks, right? They even say, don't feed that to ducks because it gets all gummy and it's not good for them to digest all these things. But he says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. The principle is, don't stop putting good things out there, right? Bread is sustenance. Bread is life, basically. That's why God uses that analogy throughout Scripture, to put things of a positive nature out there, and they will come back. God watches over his word to perform it. That's what we read in Isaiah 55. He also looks at our actions and our words to see if it reflects him. What he puts out and expects back, what do we put out to expect back? And I'd like to highlight that with a wonderful story in John's gospel. There were a couple of times when Christ fed the multitudes, and you're familiar with those accounts. This is one of them. But he took little, right? He took a limited amount, and he multiplied it to feed thousands of people. This one I find particularly interesting because Christ ends up feeding 5,000 people. But let's just read it. John 6 and verse 2. It says, then a great multitude followed him because they had saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. They were impressed. It was probably a bit selfish because they probably wanted some of that as well. If this man can heal, you know, I want to be cured of, you know, fill in the blank. So nonetheless, they're following him. So Jesus goes up the mountain and he sat there with his disciples. Now, a mountainside would be a perfect amphitheater if you're trying to teach people, right? Because your voice is going to carry down the hill. John inserts, you know, this is the Passover, the feast of the Jews was near. So verse 5, Christ lifts up his eyes, seeing a great multitude, he said to Philip, where should we buy bread that these may eat? So Christ's first thought is to take care of them, right? They're hungry. There's no corner market, right? There's no restaurant down the street. They're out on a mountainside. Where are you going to get food? So he asks Philip, and Philip's probably saying, I don't have anything, you know, pulls his pockets out or whatever. But notice verse 6, Christ said this to test him. He wanted to see Philip's response. So Philip answers, and he says, well, I have 200 denarii worth of bread, but that's nowhere enough for all these people, that every one of them could have a little bit. And so what does Christ do? Then one of his disciples, Andrew, this is Peter's brother, says, there's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish, but what are they among so many? Okay, this is the stuff that I find funny. Did anybody ask the kid if they could use his food? We don't have that written here, but Andrew looks around. Well, there's some. I don't know what he thought they would do with what Christ would do with that. So then Christ says, well, have them sit down. It was an open meadow kind of area. And so they all sat down, and it was about 5,000. And so Christ takes the loaves. He'd given thanks. He distributed them to the disciples and those sitting down, also the fish, and they had as much as they wanted, an all-you-can-eat buffet of fish and bread. And so then at the end of it, verse 12, when they were full, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain so nothing is lost. And I find that very interesting because what is Christ going to do here? He's not just wasteful. I mean, in many ways, it's not that important, is it? You got scraps left over. This is another first world problem. We have too much food, we throw it away. Okay, so, but notice what he says there. So they gather it up. And it filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves that are left over that he'd eaten. So he had one basket, this boy, had one basket with some fish and some bread, a little amount that he could carry in a basket, right? And when they're all done, now he has 12 baskets. That's quite the return, isn't it? Now, it doesn't say this, but I suspect, based on everything that we've covered here today, that they gave those 12 baskets back to the boy. Because he's the one that gave in the first place, wasn't it? It was his effort, his forethought. He seems to be the only one that thought far enough down the road to say, well, I don't know where we're going, but I need to take some food with me. This smart boy. But I just find these examples an amazing thing to consider. Christ blessed the food and the boy in the end. And so from that boy's perspective, small sacrifice. Again, we're not told what he thought. They take his basket. Am I getting anything of this? But then he gets 12 back, and everyone had more than enough to eat with all the leftovers. And so what I find in this as well is that the boy was also practicing what we read in Acts 20. It's more blessed to give than to receive. So let's look at one example, and then I'll turn to a couple of the verses, and we'll wrap this up today. But let's go next to Acts chapter 9. We have another example of, to use our terminology, a church member. And unfortunately, this church member had died. Her name was Dorcas. And she was of such a level of giving and caring and concern for people around her that she was a great loss when she died. So Acts 9 and verse 36, it says, at Joppa there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, this was also her name, which is translated Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and charitable deeds which she did. Now, some of this is elaborated on, but it says she was full of it. This was what she was known for. So verse 37, but it happened in those days that she became sick and died. And when they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. They had prepared her for burial. Since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples heard that Peter was there. They sent two men to him. So disciples in Joppa, where Tabitha or Dorcas was, they call for Peter in a nearby town. That they sent two men, imploring him not to delay in coming to them. So Peter arose, went with them, and when he had come, they brought him to the upper room, and all the widows stood by him, weeping. And not just weeping. Notice what they're doing. Showing the tunics and garments which Dorcas had made while she was with them. They all brought some examples of what she had done for them. And so then Peter had them all leave the room. He knelt down and he prayed, and he turned to the body and said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes. When she saw Peter, she sat up. Then he gave her his hand, lifted her up, and when he had called the saints and the widows, he presented her to life, and it became known throughout all Joppa. I mean, what an amazing thing to be a part of. She gave, and she was honored with that back. So let's go back to Ecclesiastes again, this time at the end of the book, chapter 12, and we'll finish with this today. We have Solomon recounting in this book all the things that he tried. If you remember, God had promised him wealth, had promised him all the things he didn't request in his prayer. He asked for wisdom because he didn't know how to lead God's people. God said, because you asked for that, that was the thing to ask for. Because you asked for that, I'll give you everything else. But Solomon didn't quite live up to that, did he? I read the book of Ecclesiastes as an old man regretting some of the decisions he made. And he's trying to pass this on to his son, which didn't seem to make much of a good impact there, unfortunately. But in Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13, Solomon comes to the conclusion of it all. And he says this, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Here's Solomon's summation at the end of his life of everything that he had done, everything that he had tried to find pleasure, everything that he thought would be important in his life, all the time, all the money, all the effort he had spent. He says, so here's the conclusion of it all. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is everything a man can be. For God's will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. What are you throwing out? That spiritual boomerang that we all have, what's going out and what's coming back? Are we putting out the things of God, and is he blessing us in those things? Are we still struggling with some of these things? Are we looking to the benefit down the road? Are we looking at what is planted? So what we will reap is the right thing. Because we're to also not only be concerned about our lives, but we're to be an example to those that watch us. And there are a lot of people that watch us, whether we realize it or not, coworkers, relatives, people we know in the neighborhood, whoever. They want to see if we live up to it. Because unfortunately, many in the Christian faith don't, as a whole, in the broad context. Are we living up to that example to show them God is faithful and true? Let's remember Isaiah 55:11, that God does not want his spirit to return without benefiting, coming back to him empty, so that it will return to him with something more that he can use. Let's remember the analogy of the spiritual boomerang.